Shalom, friends. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Access. This is Timothy, and I'm glad that we get to study the scriptures together today. Quick question. Do any of you struggle with trust issues? Like, do you have difficulty coming into agreement with something without having any substantial proof or evidence? And growing up in the religion of Christianity, I often heard the words trust, faith, and belief all thrown around kind of loosely, and they were used interchangeably without any distinction, that it caused a lot of confusion in my own mind. I remember when I was about 11 years old, just a few months after being baptized, I came across a story that was found in Mark chapter 9, where a man comes to Yeshua because his son has this evil spirit in him that caused him to be unable to speak, and it would throw him into these fits of seizure, and he'd be foaming at the mouth, and Yeshua's disciples were unable to drive out the spirit. And then the words of Yeshua that's recorded in Mark 9 verse 19, it always stood out to me when he spoke, "O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you?" And then he told his talmidim, his disciples, to bring the boy to him. When the boy was brought to him, immediately the spirit threw the boy into convulsion. Now, while the boy was convulsing on the ground, Yeshua turns to the father and kind of interviews him, right? He says, "How long has this been happening to him?" And the father replies, "Since childhood. It often tries to kill him by throwing him into the fire or into the water." And then he ends up begging Yeshua, "If you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." Now, I love Yeshua's response to him. "If you can? What do you mean, if you can? All things are possible to him who believes." Immediately, the boy's father, he cries out and he says, "I do believe. Help my unbelief." Well, here's a helpful paraphrase. "I do trust. Help my lack of trust." Now, for years, the words of Yeshua, "O you unbelieving generation, how long will I put up with you?" and the words of the boy's father, "I do believe. Help my unbelief," they seemed to taunt me as I wrestled with these words and I tried to make sense of it. I'd even ask people at church to help clarify, and they would use these prescribed textbook responses, and much of the time their responses, they came across as very trite and almost shaming. Even when I left the church and went on my own quest for the truths of the universe, and dipping into different religions and spiritual practices, for some reason those words always stayed with me in my heart. Now, I was young, my faith was young, and I felt lonely in that journey, and I grew anxious in my quest for truth. And this was a dangerous combination, a lack of faith and anxiety. It usually leads you to take matters into your own hands and trust nothing and nobody but yourself, and sometimes not even yourself. So this message of believe in yourself can be a dangerous one because it leads to unbelief. Unbelief in God. So just because I was confused and I had questions and doubts about my faith journey, it didn't mean that I was at a total loss. In hindsight, I'm able to see how God allowed me to have those experiences as I was sincerely seeking truth, digging deeper that allowed me to discover the absolute truth that is His. Even today, He continues to develop my faith daily, by helping me learn to trust Him even more and more. Friends, the root of anxiety is a lack of faith or unbelief. And unbelief is the root of evil. Hebrews 3 verse 12 reads, "Watch out, brothers, so that there will not be in any one of you an evil heart lacking trust, which could lead you to apostatize from the living God." I ask again, do any of you struggle with trust issues? When it comes to your journey in following Yeshua, walking in Torah, living for His kingdom, do you place your trust in Him? Do you believe what He says in His word? Do you have faith in His faithfulness to His promises? Our study today is called Anxious Actions. Now, if you need a handout for today's Access Learn study, please visit our Facebook group, Connections Ministries of Canada, and you'll find all of our studies under the Files tab. Also visit our website at connectionsministries.com. As we continue through our Genesis study, I want to recommend that you have a Bible handy so you can follow along with us. And I encourage you to take some time with your own Access church communities or your small groups and review this study together. Now let's get started. Anxious actions. Today, my wife Beverly will be reading from Genesis chapter 16 to 18, verse 15, from the Complete Jewish Bible.
Chapter 16. Now Sarai, Avram's wife, had not borne him a child, but she had an Egyptian slave girl named Hagar. So Sarai said to Avram, "Hear now, Adonai has kept me from having children, so go in and sleep with my slave girl. Maybe I'll be able to have children through her." Avram listened to what Sarai said. It was after Avram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan that Sarai, Avram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her slave girl, and gave her to Avram, her husband, to be his wife. Avram had sexual relations with Hagar, and she conceived. But when she became aware that she was pregnant, she looked on her mistress with contempt. Sarai said to Avram, "This outrage being done to me is your fault. True, I gave my slave girl to you to sleep with, but when she saw that she was pregnant, she began holding me in contempt. May Adonai decide who is right, I or you." However, Avram answered Sarai, "Look, she is your slave girl. Deal with her as you think fit." Then Sarai treated her so harshly that she ran away from her. The angel of Adonai found her by a spring in the desert, the spring on the road to Shur, and said, "Hagar, Sarai's slave girl, where have you come from and where are you going?" She answered, "I'm running away from my mistress Sarai." The angel of Adonai said to her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her authority." The angel of Adonai said to her, "I will greatly increase your descendants. There will be so many that it will be impossible to count them." The angel of Adonai said to her, "Look, you are pregnant, and you will give birth to a son. You are to call him Yishmael. God pays attention, because Adonai has paid attention to your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man, with his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, living his life at odds with all his kinsmen." So she named Adonai, who had spoken with her, El Roy, God of seeing, because she said, "Have I really seen the one who sees me and stayed alive?" This is why the well has been called Bir Lachai Roy, well of the one who lives and sees. It lies between Kadesh and Bered. Hagar bore Avram a son, and Avram called the son whom Hagar had borne Ishmael. Avram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Avram. Chapter 17. When Avram was 99 years old, Adonai appeared to Avram and said to him, "I am El Shaddai. Walk in my presence and be pure-hearted. I will make my covenants between me and you, and I will increase your numbers greatly." Avram fell on his face, and God continued speaking with him. "As for me, this is my covenant with you. You will be the father of many nations. Your name will no longer be Avram, exalted father, but your name will be Avraham, father of many, because I have made you the father of many nations. I will cause you to be very fruitful. I will make nations of you. Kings will descend from you. I am establishing my covenant between me and you, along with your descendants after you, generation after generation, as an everlasting covenant, to be God for you and your descendants after you. I will give you and your descendants after you the land in which you are now foreigners, all the land of Canaan, as a permanent possession, and I will be their God." God said to Abraham, "As for you, you are to keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, generation after generation. Here is my covenant, which you are to keep between me and you, along with your descendants after you. Every male among you is to be circumcised. You are to be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin. This will be the sign of the covenant between me and you. Generation after generation, every male among you who is 8 days old is to be circumcised, including slaves born within your household and those bought from a foreigner not descended from you. The slave born in your house and the person bought with your money must be circumcised. Thus my covenant will be in your flesh as an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who will not let himself be circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person will be cut off from his people, because he has broken my covenant." God said to Abraham, "As for Sarah your wife, you are not to call her Sarai, mockery. Her name is to be Sarah, princess. I will bless her, moreover, I will give you a son by her. Truly, I will bless her. She will be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her." At this, Avraham fell on his face and laughed. He thought to himself, "Will a child be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah give birth at 90? Avraham said to God, "If only Ishmael could live in your presence." God answered, "No, but Sarah your wife will bear you a son, and you are to call him Yitzchak." Laughter. "I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. But as for Ishmael, I have heard you. I have blessed him. I will make him fruitful and give him many descendants. He will father 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But I will establish my covenant with Yitzchak, whom Sarah will bear to you at this time next year." With that, God finished speaking with Avraham and went up from him. Avraham took Ishmael his son, all the slaves born in his house, and all who had been bought with his money, every male among the people in Avraham's household, and circumcised the flesh of their foreskin that very day, just as God had said to him. Avraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, and Ishmael his son was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. Avraham and Ishmael his son were circumcised on the same day. All the men in his household, both slaves born in his house and those bought with money from a foreigner, were circumcised with him. Chapter 18. Adonai appeared to Avraham by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the entrance to the tent during the heat of the day. He raised his eyes and looked, and there in front of him stood three men. On seeing them, he ran from the tent door to meet them, prostrated himself on the ground, and said, "My lord, if I have found favor in your sight, please don't leave your servant. Please let me send for some water so that you can wash your feet, then rest under the tree, and I will bring a piece of bread. Now that you have come to your servant, refresh yourselves before going on." "Very well," they replied. "Do what you have said." Avraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, 3 measures of the best flour, knead it and make cakes." Avraham ran to the herd, took a good tender calf and gave it to the servant, who hurried to prepare it. Then he took curds, milk, and the calf which he had prepared, and set it all before the men, and he stood by them under the tree as they ate. They said to him, "Where is Sarah your wife?" He said, "There, in the tent." He said, "I will certainly return to you around this time next year, and Sarah your wife will have a son." Sarah heard him from the entrance of the tent, behind him. Avraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself, thinking, "I am old, and so is my lord. Am I to have pleasure again?" Adonai said to Avraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and ask, 'Am I really going to bear a child when I am so old? Is anything too hard for Adonai? At the time set for it, at this season next year, I will return to you, and Sarah will have a son.'" Sarah denied it, saying, "I didn't laugh," because she was afraid. He said, "Not so. You did laugh."
Before we get into observing chapter 16 a little closer, I would like to review at the beginning of chapter 15 the conversation that Avram was having with God. Avram was concerned, and he asked God, "What good are all these gifts that you're giving me if I continue childless? You haven't given me a child yet. Why don't I take Eliezer here, my servant? Why don't I take him as my heir so that he could inherit all these gifts?" And God explicitly told Avram, "No, this man will not be your heir. Your heir will be a child from your own body." God was very clear here, and it's a good thing he was, before Avram decided to do something by taking matters into his own hands. As though God's plan wasn't good enough, he would have kind of gotten in the way there. And that's kind of what we see happening here at the beginning of chapter 16 with Sarai. She decided to take matters into her own hands, solving her problem of being childless in her own way. So she takes her Egyptian servant girl named Hagar and offers her to Avram as a sort of a wife substitute, not as an actual wife, but as a concubine, simply for the purpose of making babies. So we know that Hagar was Egyptian, and Hebrew tradition actually affirms that Hagar was a princess of Egypt and was given away by Pharaoh some 5 years earlier when he had expelled Avram's household from Egypt. Sarai's plan went exactly as expected. "Well, God's not giving me a child, so here, take my servant girl and have sex with her. Maybe we'll be able to have a child through her." So Avram agreed. He went, had sex with a servant girl, and sure enough, she conceived. Now, in all fairness, God did say to Avram that his heir would be a child from his own body. He didn't necessarily say that it would be from Sarai. Perhaps that's why he decided to go along with Sarai's plan. When Hagar discovered that she was pregnant, why did she look on Sarai with contempt? Well, Hagar would have lost social position in the eyes of the people. And the child that Hagar was carrying would belong to Avram and Sarai, not her. Remember, she belonged to Sarai as a servant girl, and she remained the handmaiden. She never actually became a legal wife of Avram's. So it's no wonder that Hagar would be motivated to behave more as an equal with Sarai. And of course, now Sarai is looking at her situation, and notice her behavior and her language as she confronts the current situation. It was her great idea to offer Hagar to Avram so that they could have a child. But now she comes running up to Avram, blaming him. "This outrage being done to me is your fault. True, I gave you my slave girl to sleep with, but when she saw that she was pregnant, she began holding me in contempt. May Adonai decide who's right, I or you." What a piece of work, huh? She now blames Avram for the way that Hagar's treating her. Have you ever had a plan that seemed to be like a really good idea until it was carried out and then you didn't know what to do next? And sometimes all you end up doing when you don't know what to do is vent and complain. And that's precisely what we see Sarai doing here with Avram. She didn't need his permission to get rid of Hagar or anything like that because Hagar was still her handmaiden. She could do whatever she wanted with her. But what Sarai ended up doing was just treating her really harshly, so harshly that Hagar ran away, pregnant and afraid. In verse 7, we are introduced to a character called the Angel of Adonai, who finds Hagar by a spring in the desert. Now, who is this Angel of Adonai? If you have your handout for this Access Learned study handy, then it would be helpful right now to look at your sidebar. The Hebrew word malach means messenger, and it usually pertains to a human messenger. That malach, translated into Greek, becomes angeloi, where we get our English word for angel. But any time that we see that word malach standing by itself written in the Hebrew scriptures, it simply means messenger, and it's usually human. But when malach is paired with Adonai, the term that's actually used here, malach Adonai, it literally means a messenger from God. Another important thing to note here is the use of Adonai in the Hebrew scriptures. This term is actually a replacement word for the Hebrew name of God, which is written in four Hebrew letters, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, or transliterated as YHWH. And you've probably heard it articulated most commonly as Yahweh or Jehovah. Or you may have already heard me pronouncing it as Yehovah. If you were to open your Bibles today and look at the Old Testament, you're going to find four letters making up the word Lord, but they're all capitalized. This is also a substitution for the original Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So who is this character that we're meeting in verse 7, this angel of the Lord, or this Malach Adonai? Well, we don't know exactly. Whether it was a special kind of angel, or maybe a manifestation of God, like the Logos, the Word, or the Holy Spirit. Was it a specific angel that God set aside for certain tasks, or was this God taking on the form of an angel? We don't know. One thing we could be certain of here is that the being that spoke with Hagar was a spirit being and not a human messenger. After instructing Hagar to return to Sarai and submit to her authority, the Malach Adonai speaks in the first-person voice of Yehovah God himself as he makes his declaration that she will have many descendants and the child that she's carrying is to be named Yishmael, which means God pays attention, because Jehovah God saw her there and was sensitive to her plight. The Malach Adonai also pronounces the child's destiny. And eventually we come to see that Ishmael becomes the patriarch of several races and family lines, and most famously, the Arabs. And it's interesting that the land of the Arabs, Arabia, eventually came to be located where? East of Israel. At the end of chapter 16, we see that Avram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Avram. And we learn at the beginning of Genesis 17 that Avram is now 99 years old. And God reaffirms the covenant that he had made with Avram 29 years earlier, that the land of Canaan would forever belong to his descendants. God then changes Avram's name to Avraham. Where Avram means exalted father, it was changed to Avraham, which means the father of many. As God would cause Avram to become fruitful and become the father of many goyim, or nations. This was God's unconditional covenant. It was unilateral, it was completely up to God, and God promised that he was going to do this and Avram didn't have to worry about anything. So from the time that God had made this covenant with Avram, it's important to know that the land technically belonged to the Hebrews already, but they just had simply not taken possession of it yet. In verse 9, we see God building upon that unconditional covenant with a conditional covenant. Now, this conditional covenant was bilateral, not unilateral, where Avraham and his descendants had obligations to perform in order to keep the covenant intact. And this covenant was individual. Each person from Avraham's line would need to accept this covenant for himself or not. This was a sign that they chose to participate in the Abrahamic covenant, giving loyalty to the God of Abraham. In verse 10, God says, "Here is my covenant, which you are to keep between me and you, along with your descendants after you. Every male among you is to be circumcised." So the circumcision was the sign of the covenant. In verse 15, we see God telling Avraham not to call his wife Sarai anymore. Sarai means mockery, and God changes her name to Sarah, which means princess. And Jehovah would bless her and make her the mother of many nations through a child of her own, to be named Yitzchak, or Isaac, which means laughter. Now Ishmael would still be blessed, but the covenant would be established through Yitzhak, whom Sarah would bear to Avraham in a year's time. In verse 23, we see Avraham accepting this covenant for himself, his son, and his entire household. In obedience to what God had told him, he circumcised the flesh of their foreskin that very day. Avraham was 99 years old, and Ishmael was 13 years old. Now, this practice of male circumcision, it actually existed long before God had instructed Avraham to do this. It wasn't a new invention, you know, just like the covenant ceremony was already something that was being practiced by many cultures in that time. But the practice of circumcision was typically used in a marriage ceremony, or more typically as a sign of entrance into puberty, so boys aged 8 to 13 years old or so. And God changed this process, and he took the trauma out of it by having it performed not on young teenage boys, but on an 8-day-old baby. And in addition, God, he employed this existing rite as a sort of a loyal oath, and he added a much greater meaning to it. Just like when he put the rainbow in the sky, God again uses something from nature when he chooses to create a sign for his own good purposes. After all, every one of these natural things owed its very existence to God. But sadly, many have attached their own misguided meanings, like astrology, to these things that God had made. All right, I have to admit that many times I've read through this story and I'm just like, but why circumcision? Well, let's look at it this way. It's a covenant, okay? And the Jews call this covenant the Brit Mila. So there's a cutting of the covenant. Now remember that God's standard covenant protocol required three things. One, the shedding of blood, typically animal blood. Two, the cutting of flesh, typically animal flesh. And three, the separating of that flesh into two groups. So in circumcision, the male body is used as the sacrificial flesh. So the flesh is cut, the blood is shed, and then the cut-up flesh was separated. The penalty for refusing the circumcision covenant was very stern. You were to be cut off from your people, and this meant both spiritually and literally. That even when a male descendant of Abraham refuses the circumcision, or when a parent of a refused to have their boy child have a brit milah on the eighth day after birth, they would physically be separated from the clan, and they were spiritually separated from God, so they were no longer Hebrews, and they could claim no right to any of God's promises. Many years later, God explains through Paul that what he really wanted was circumcised hearts, not circumcised flesh alone. And we see this in Romans chapter 2, verses 25 to 29. It reads, "For circumcision is indeed of value if you do what Torah says. But if you are a transgressor of Torah, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. Therefore, if an uncircumcised man keeps the righteous requirements of the Torah, won't his uncircumcision be counted as circumcision? Indeed, the man who is physically uncircumcised but obeys the Torah will stand as a judgment on you who have the Brit Milah and have Torah written out but violate it. For the real Jew is not merely Jewish outwardly. True circumcision is not only external and physical. On the contrary, the real Jew is one inwardly, and true circumcision is of the heart, spiritual, not literal, so that his praise comes not from other people, but from God." So by accepting Christ, Messiah Yeshua, Paul says that we have our hearts circumcised, and we are very literally accepting God's covenant protocol upon ourselves. And since the coming of Yeshua and the new covenant that he established, we find ourselves in the same position as Abraham. Either we are circumcised by accepting the new covenant, which is his blood spilled at the cross, or we refuse it. If we accept it, we are perpetually a part of the chosen people of God. And if we refuse it, we are cut off, separated from God's people and from God himself. Now, while this might startle some of you, Paul's words, they probably knocked his Jewish audience right to their knees. They totally understood all the ins and outs of this covenant ceremony and its symbolism. But because the church has for so long turned our backs on the Jewish nature of the Bible, the impact of things like the act of covenant making has not been properly understood. And looking back here in Genesis 17 verse 12, you see this principle and pattern that it was not just those from Abraham's gene pool that could be part of this covenant. Even the homeborn slaves or the purchased slaves of a Hebrew, these foreigners, they could also be included in the covenant by being circumcised. So we have to understand that by law, a purchased slave became a family member. They had almost all the rights of a family member. And a baby born to a purchased slave also became a family member. Now, this concept might seem a little foreign to us in our current understanding of slavery, because these foreign slaves of the Hebrews, they weren't generally mistreated. Why? Because they were family. So this concept of slave ownership amongst the Hebrews was very close to our modern concept of adoption. Beginning with Abraham, a foreigner who was willing to follow the Hebrew ways and the Hebrew God could be given full citizenship as a Hebrew and with all the covenant rights that any natural Hebrew would have. And this is the very same principle that Gentiles rely on by being grafted into the covenants given through Abraham, Moshe, and Yeshua. Covenants that were given to who? To Israel and no one else. So we see how Abraham's anxious actions play a role here. When God promised him, listen, you're going to have this land and you're going to have a ton of descendants, but he had no child yet? Well, he wanted to take Eliezer from Damascus as his own heir. But then God says, listen, no, he will not be your heir. Your heir will be a child from your own body. So then the anxious actions a few years later, you have both Sarai and Abraham coming together and being like,
okay, we don't have a kid yet, so let's sleep with Hagar, and then along comes Ishmael. And again, these anxious actions rise up in Abraham in verse 17 of 17, where Abraham falls on his face and laughs when God had just told him that Sarai would be the one to give him a child. It's kind of funny at this point because his son Ishmael, who he considered to be his firstborn for the past 13 years, imagine that. To be Abraham and you think, okay, here's my firstborn. This promise of God is going to be coming real. I've been hanging on to this promise for the past 24 years. And now there's this other promise that I have to keep on my end, cut off everybody's foreskin and wait to have another child. How long will it be before he grows up? Man, how many times have we acted out of our own anxiety where we've gotten in the way of God's plan? We feel that we've been following him, we've been trying our best, and for some reason we grow impatient and we take matters into our own hands. Much of the time we end up thinking, well, I messed that up, I may as well give up now. Friends, I want to encourage you, hang on to God's promises. Follow his leading. We never have the full picture, and that's why it's so important for us to learn to place our trust in him. What are you going to do? Start trusting yourself and all your poor decisions? All your great ideas? Friends, our God is a faithful God. He's faithful to his promises. He always does what he says he's going to do. Can you trust that? Can you trust him? As we close off our study today, we see in Genesis chapter 18, in the first half of Genesis 18, we see God do something awesome here. Verse 1 begins with, Adonai appeared to Abraham. Imagine this. Adonai appeared. And in the original script, it wouldn't have said Adonai. It has the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Yehovah appeared to Abraham. Only Abraham doesn't know that it's him. Or whatever manifestation God chose to present himself with this time. It says that there were three men that came to visit. And we see Abraham kind of jump up and he's like, oh my Lord, come eat here, stay here, rest for a while. You see all this fuss over his visitors? It was nothing out of the ordinary. This was just traditional Middle Eastern hospitality in that era. So who were these three men exactly? Well, like it said very clearly in verse 1, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh appeared to Abraham. Could you imagine God or even angels eating the food that was prepared for them by Abraham and Sarah? I've always been a little confused by that little detail because angels don't eat. And one of the only ways I could kind of reconcile this for myself is that this manifestation of the three men would actually have been Yehovah himself. Nowhere in these passages does it read Malach Adonai. This isn't an angel of the Lord, but it is a supernatural thing that's happening here. And these so-called three men were sitting there and eating and fellowshipping with Abraham. And we know something supernatural is happening because we're told directly and undeniably that there was this appearance of Yehovah and that these three individuals had authority and they knew things that they wouldn't have otherwise known, such as Sarah's name and the fact that she was barren. Yet these all-knowing visitors in verse 9 still ask a question. Where's your wife Sarah? As if they didn't already know. The fact is that spirit beings, particularly God, usually he dumbs things down significantly in order to communicate things with us mere humans. And perhaps this rhetorical question was just a way of them politely bringing Sarah into the conversation. Now we see Sarah do something that, you know, most of us human beings would do when we're curious about something. We see her kind of eavesdrop and listen through the tent walls. Who are these three mysterious guys? And as she's listening, she hears the promise that was made. And she nearly drops over, probably trying to stifle her laughter, and she's laughing to herself. But this wasn't an excited sort of laughter. You know, it wasn't like a joy-filled laughter. That you can't contain. You can't stifle that. Right? This sort of laughter was more one of disbelief. Like, who are these crazy guys coming in here making these sort of promises? She was laughing in ridicule. So when Yehovah asked why Sarah laughed, She was busted. God made it clear that Sarah would have a son. Why? Because he decided it. And it was going to happen within a year. I love the phrase that we read here in verse 14, where it says, "Is anything too hard for Adonai?" Friends, anything is possible with Jehovah God. Who are we to doubt him? Who are we to question his plan? It would be wise for us to check ourselves, come to God in prayer, submit ourselves to his way and learn his ways, and then walk in obedience and faith, trusting and obeying the way that Abraham did. I know sometimes it seems like where God is leading us, it seems impossible or ridiculous, and we might respond the way that Sarah did, laughing in ridicule and disbelief. Oftentimes we might find ourselves saying things like, "Well, I've tried that already. I've gone that way. What more is there to do?" Friends, that's a picture of trusting in yourself. I want to leave you with the words written in Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5 to 6, where it says, "Trust in Yahweh with all your heart, and do not rely on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, then he will level your paths." Aren't you tired of living your life in anxiety and doubt and fear? It's my prayer that we experience the shalom of God, this sense of well-being and peace, that we're able to truly live a life of abundance as we walk with him, as we walk in Torah and make a life in the way of Yeshua. Friends, thank you so much for joining us for today's Access Learn study. It's always a joy to be able to get around God's word and learn more about his plan and his purposes, and about his amazing love and his promises. And I'm so excited to see where he'll lead us next. May the grace of our Lord Yeshua and the shalom of God our Father be with all.